Kay Billy Super Sounds of the 70s weekend just keeps on coming with this little ditty that reached up to 21 in May of 1970. The George Baker selection, Little Green Bag.
A League podcast, the director series, Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs. I'm Matt Durson.
And I'm Mr. Purple, because I'm not on that gig that happens in this movie. John Hunt.
Pink Inferno here.
All right. I guess I should have come up with a color, but didn't.
Isn't there an Aerosmith song, Pink is the
It's a bank on your lava.
Wow.
Really bad era of Aerosmith.
You mean their entire career?
Fuck you, man. That was fighting words.
Okay. Jesus. Just because we're from Boston. All right, so this is our third director series. We've each picked one. This is my pick, Reservoir Dogs, Quentin Tarantino's first major motion picture. Technically, he made like a... something that's basically a step up from a student film. I got his basic Durst and the Firestarter. It was like a 70-minute movie that he did before this, but it doesn't really count because he didn't have like studio backing or anything. So this is it. This is his first movie. And it still holds up quite well, I think. But
see a little of the amateurishness here and there, but overall, yeah.
Overall, you can see like where he was going, I think.
It is obviously grit like that. I like an amateurist grit to the movie.
We've talked about this a lot with other, like Sam Raimi and stuff like that, where like the budget for this movie was like about a little over $1 million, 1.2, I think. So like, you know, he was limited, but he did probably spend a lot of that on
spent it all on beer.
Well, maybe some on beer. Probably spent a lot.
Spent
on
all
songs.
Stuck in the Middle with You used most of the song budget out of that pie.
Wow. Yeah. So, you know, when it's kind of like you do the best of what you got, you know, kind of thing. That kind of filmmaking. It's fun. And back in this day, this came out. Well, it went to Sundance. January 21st, 1992, released in the U.S. October 9th, 1992. 32 years ago. It's pretty crazy.
Wow.
Can you believe it?
We were sort of admiring some of the 90s-ishness to it. Like when Emil Blonsky, why am I blanking on his real name?
Tim Roth.
Yeah, Tim Roth comes walking in the diner and Mrs. Elder goes, there's a 90s look, like his hair. He looks like he should be in a boy band from the 90s, like NSYNC or something.
The hair is pretty weird.
Because there was one scene, I was like, I think I probably wore something just like that back then.
Like the sort of Hawaiian kind of shirt he's got?
Well, it's like, you know, like a hoodie thing on and like the jeans with like the particular, you know, hiking boots and stuff that he was wearing in one scene. So.
Yeah, I mean, those scenes are a little dated, but for the most part, like the suits and, you know, like, and the music is all from the 70s. The suits are kind of, you know, sort of evergreen. Like they all wear just a black suit with a white shirt and a black tie.
And a very skinny tie.
Yeah, and speaking of the budget, most of the clothing budget was, they saved a lot of money because people wore their own clothes.
Yeah. Chris Penn wore his own. That's his track jacket. And the clothing, the designer donated the suits for free. So,
excellent.
They saved some money there. Yeah, I mean, back then, this was what, you know, I mean, this was what I wanted to do, basically. When I went to film school, I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna make movies like this. No money, just a bunch of people who want to make a movie.
Bunch of jerks making a movie.
And, you know, this is exactly the kind of movie I thought one day I would be making.
You still can.
I guess I can, sure. I could just get out my iPhone, which I don't have.
Yeah, it's even easier now to make a movie than it was then.
Yeah, that's the problem. It's all these schmucks. They can make a movie. Yeah, I was going to be in the next Quentin Tarantino, basically. I think
just about
exactly like this. Yeah.
I think just about everyone at this point in time was trying to be the next Quentin Tarantino. As we worked in a video store for a couple of years in the 90s, it was just knockoff, knockoff, knockoff that would come into the store.
God. Actually, funny story about that. Before I worked there, but I wanted to rent this. I heard about this movie. You know, like, I was like, oh, everybody's like, you got to go see Reservoir Dogs. And I said, okay. It didn't really play very much in theaters, but I wanted to rent it. And the guy who was working there, who didn't work there when we got there, but his name was Dave, and he was the golden boy back then. But he was like a film guy too, but he's like, oh, this movie is terrible. They just beat up a cop for 15 minutes. There's like no story at all. I was like, oh, well, all right. It's, still sounds kind of cool, you know. I don't know.
I like when people beat up cops. Let's see.
Yeah, right. I was like, I wonder, like, if he thought I was some kind of savage, because I was like, oh, all right, I mean, sure. I mean, I have no problem with on-screen violence. I'm not saying yes.
Saying killing for the sake of killing.
Yeah, killing for the sake of killing. But that was part of the problem with all those knockoffs, you know. There was a lot of just killing for the sake of killing. And as violent as this movie is, a lot of people do die, but it's not like...
Yeah, it's not that. It's not as horrible as I... Because I've only seen it once, like 30 years ago. So I could only remember little bits of it.
I mean, I've seen it many, many times. And then I watched it twice in the last week. And I thought of you, Clay, when I read this tidbit. He was influenced by Stanley Kubrick's 1956 film, The Killing.
The Killing, yes, another fine one back in the day.
The quote
and
I read,
all of his other video store influences, of course.
Right, right. Well, a lot of movies, a lot of Japanese, like John Woo kind of movies. All the main characters named after the colors was taken from The Taking of Pelham 123, which I think mentioned on a podcast recently, and I don't remember which one, but definitely talked about.
Probably thinking that someone was like a cinematographer or something that worked on
probably
or
somebody who worked
screenwriter maybe.
I like both of those movies, the new one and the old.
I haven't seen either one.
It's the old one has like Walter Matthau, right? And here's another knowledge drop that has nothing to do with this movie, but Homer Simpson's original voice was an imitation of Walter Matthau.
Oh boy.
Is that when it comes out, you step on him.
All right. So, yeah, just a quick rundown here. Quentin Tarantino, as we all, I mean, most people probably know the story. He was working in a video store, as we mentioned. And, like, the weird thing, the video store had this, like, class where you could, like, take filmmaking. It was, I don't know how, I don't quite get what happened there, but, you know, he met some people, he learned some tricks, and then, like, his partner Lawrence Bender was in an acting class with like Harvey Keitel's wife or something. Like it's a very weird thing, but somehow, so the script got into the hands of Harvey Keitel. And once he said, yeah, I like this. I would like to do this movie. And he was able to like get other people
he's a producer.
Interested. Yeah. And he is listed as a producer. But mostly like, I think he did shell out some money, but it was also like his name got people interested and other people who would shell out money and other actors and everything. So, but also Tony Scott was interested in directing this movie, and Quentin said, no, I'm going to direct this one, but you can have True Romance. And so
Scott, he hates what Tony Scott did to True Romance.
I don't think he minds that so much. He hates what Oliver Stone did to
Netflix. Maybe that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. I don't think he minds that. I think he liked Tony Scott, and Tony Scott did give him $50,000, which went right into making this movie. But yeah, he said he never saw Natural Born Killers. Also makes me think, well, how can you hate it?
I know he hated the Rodney Dangerfield scene, I like that scene.
Really? Well, I mean,
Again, I haven't seen the movie in 30 years, so maybe I would not.
I listened to an interview with him, so he's like kind of seen parts of it, and
okay.
He thinks that like maybe a minute or two of it that he likes. It's like when it's on cable, he flips, he's like puts it on for a minute, and then he gets angry and flips away.
I mean, it's fine, whatever. I mean, I just love Robert Downey Jr. And I think that was the thing. I think Quentin wanted to play that role, and he just, you know, he was going to be more of a central character, and it ended up being more about Mickey and Mallory. But maybe someday we'll do that one, because I do enjoy that movie, unlike Quentin Tarantino. So, in fact, Quentin Tarantino also wanted to play Mr. Pink in this movie.
I'm glad he didn't, because...
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to be honest. Quentin Tarantino, I find him a bit annoying.
Absolutely.
Oh, and I mean, I he's got snappy dialogue and stuff, but I was kind of just like, oh god, let's hurry up and get over this Madonna thing, like, because you're just bugging the fuck out of me, and I'm glad you get shot in the head.
I know, it's a great, if he had played Mr. Pink, there's no way that this movie would have been, I don't think it would have gone. I mean, just his acting is just not that good. He's a great director, don't get me wrong, but his acting is not great. He's like in all of his movies, pretty much.
Yeah, like a nerdy guy that thinks he's tough.
Yeah. Anyways, yeah, but let's get to the movie itself. Yeah, it starts off, as you brought up, they're sitting around a diner, bunch of guys, and they're talking about Madonna's Like a Virgin. It's a pretty funny scene. Actually, this place that they're sitting in is Pat and Lorraine's Coffee Shop, which is in Eagle Rock in Los Angeles. And I don't know, for some reason I looked it up. They serve something called a pancake sandwich, which sounds pretty good, and maybe a heart attack waiting ahead. But yeah, first they talk about True Blue. Now, I read somewhere that somebody says Madonna's song True Blue, like the blue is referencing like Cops, but I don't know. Maybe that's just a stretch. Maybe Quentin Tarantino, as you say, is known for his snappy dialogue, and this is, you know, he's talking about what Like a Virgin's about. This was like a big monologue back in the day. It was on the soundtrack itself.
Yeah, I remember he always put it on the mix.
Yeah.
Because I remember the tick, 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 tick.
That is the funny part. And I love how you can tell when the guy says, how many dicks is that? He goes, a lot. Like, you could tell he has no time for this. Apparently, like, Madonna gave Quentin, a signed copy of her record, and she wrote on it, Quentin, it's not about dick, it's about love.
Yeah, see, here you go.
Yeah.
These were the kinds of conversations I was having in the 90s with my friends, though, trying to look cool and be like, yeah, so, you know, I'd be in like the cafeteria of Mass Art, like trying to recreate Reservoir Dogs like every day. You know, it's like we didn't have phones to be looking at, scrolling through. We had to talk
in a little black suit with your skinny tie and your sunglasses.
Yeah. I actually dressed more like I was in Swingers, but same point taken.
We'll get to that.
We did that in film school as well, and we did it at the video stores. We did it wherever. Yeah, because you're right. We didn't have phones.
We had to talk to each other.
Yeah, we talked
about
dumb shit.
These kids don't even know how to talk to each other anymore.
Hold on, I got to shake my fist at this cloud.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the camera is like spinning around, and you brought up Swingers. They actually sort of mimic this shot in Swingers, where they're all sitting around like talking about Scorsese and stuff like. But the camera moving around the table. I mean, it's pretty cool stuff. But yeah, they make their first reference to K. Billy's Super Sounds of the 70s, which they all listen to. And it's a radio station that later on we find out Stephen Wright is K. Billy.
I have a knowledge drop on that too, which is the various radio spots that you hear. There's an ad for Jackrabbit Slims, the movie that's in Pulp, the
restaurant, the sock hop or whatever.
Yeah, but I was trying to, what is it, Planet Hollywood or Hard Rock Cafe of Pulp Fiction.
Right. We also get in this scene the sort of infamous Mr. Pink doesn't tip bit, which is pretty funny. Steve Buscemi is really good.
Mrs. Elder was getting a little triggered by that.
Really?
Like in a sort of humorous way.
Right. I mean, you know, I'm not, obviously he's saying... Well, it's sort of like just it's lending him his character. This is his character, you know, and he's just right. He's just saying. I mean, I'll say this: when he says, "Why do you tip the people in a restaurant? You don't tip the people at McDonald's." He's like, "They're serving you food." I mean, and it's
here's the difference. McDonald's McDonald's worker is actually making minimum wage, which he says the waitress is as well. But a waitress or wait staff do not. They always make less, and that's that's why you have to tip. I don't really understand why that's the way it is here in America. It's dumb. We're pay them what they're worth, and we'll pay for the meal. Just we don't whatever.
I know. I don't get it either. It doesn't make any sense. And there's been talk over the years like, oh, we're just going to pay wait staff, well, you know.
Oh, but if we do that, then we have to raise all the prices. But if we're already paying for a tip in there, but just raise the price to what? Fuck it. Whatever. I don't care. Just, I don't want to tip anymore. Pay them a wage that's good. So anyway, that's my thing.
Oh, because, but then like some people don't tip, you know, like just like Mr. Prink. Yeah. But he does also say one thing he says is like he didn't have a job that society deemed tip worthy, which I thought was kind of a. But you're right. I mean, even when I made minimum wage at the movie theater, I didn't make tips. But I
when I delivered pizzas, I did make tips, and that was a nice benefit to it. But manager getting in my face, not in my face. He was giving me a little bit of a because something, and he was like, you get paid for, you know, your hourly rate, and then you get paid for your gas, and I was like, my hourly rate is lower than everybody else's, and the gas goes to gas, so
yeah, gas is really expensive.
Yeah, so get off my back.
Anyway, it's kind of so we kind of learn about a lot of the different characters, and one thing we learn about Joe Lawrence Tierney when he says, cough up a buck, you cheap bastard, I paid for your goddamn breakfast. Which is kind of funny. Lawrence Tierney apparently was very difficult to work with in this movie, but he's pretty funny. But yeah, so then we get like the famous, the first Stephen Wright introducing the song, and then it's Little Green Bag, and this thing has been spoofed a bunch of times too. They're all walking in slow motion.
Hey, you used to have a t-shirt of it.
Yeah, I had a t-shirt and I had a Mr. Blonde poster at one point. Yeah. Yeah, so the next scene, we go right from Little Green Bag to Mr. Orange screaming in the back seat, bloody as hell, saying, I can't believe she shot me. And Harvey Keitel, Mr. White, is in the front seat, and he's trying to reassure him. And I like it. He says, you're going to be okay. He's saying the goddamn words. It's really nice. He's really trying to help him out.
Yeah, because he feels responsible for it.
Yes.
This is one of the shots in the car that I was like, where I was referring to, you can see a little bit of the amateurism in there. They're like driving like 15 miles an hour on the road.
Wouldn't they be driving like 75 or whatever, trying to get away from the cop? Maybe they're trying not to attract attention.
Oh, that's got to be it.
Yeah. Well, no prize. So they kick open this door. They're back at their rendezvous. He says, we're going back to our rendezvous. And he goes in. They go into this warehouse. There's a guy, actually, a crew member in the background. As the door, like, swings open and then closed again, you can see him dart behind. There's some amateur filmmaking. So he lays him down. He's like, oh, Joe's going to get you to a doctor. And, he's going to be fine. We'll wait for Joe and wait for Joe. And it's nice. Mr. Orange is like, hold me. Which... I mean, one thing I was watching today on YouTube is they talk about one thing about this movie is people actually react like they've been shot when they get shot. And they actually act like they're in pain.
This is essentially me with kidney stones, as I was saying. It's that bad. It's that painful that you're like, the whole time.
Yeah, I believe it. So then he even like combs his hair, which is kind of maybe he's like, this 90s look isn't really. For you,
yeah. Let's get a little less boy band.
But he's so Orange. Finally, says, "Hey, like, why don't you just take me to a hospital?" And he's like, "I can't do that." He's like, fuck jail." He says, "Just take me to the hospital. Leave me on the sidewalk, and I'll be, because he knows he's gonna die." But Mr. White is basically telling him, "Like, you'll be. It takes days to die from a gut shot, but it's really painful. But you'll be fine." But he's lying. He will die. So. And then we get Mr. Pink. Stevie Savvy comes in like a bat out of hell. And he's asking all these questions. And he says, we were set up. And we do find out that Brown is dead, which is fine. Because he It's annoying. No, we don't. But then we don't know who Brown was anyway. But we know anyway. Yeah, Mr. Pink. And he's like, yeah, they were set up. And there's like all this debate about what happened at the robbery, which we never show. We never see. And that was intentional, obviously, and also because they didn't have any money. So it's kind of like, so yeah, it's funny that they go through what happens. And Mr. Pink says, no, the cops were there waiting for us. They had the place staked out. So they're pretty sure there's a rat in the house. And we established Mr. Blonde, who, again, we don't know which one was Mr. Blonde yet, but he shot up everybody, shot everybody in the place, whatever. And I like, so there's like a moment Mr. White starts saying like, all right, enough of this Mr. White shit. And he's like, hey, don't tell me your name. I don't want to know, because they get caught. You know, it's the whole thing. If they get caught, then they can't. It's like plausible deniability. It's like they don't know who their accomplices were. And then we have a cool one of the parts that's not in the warehouse, Mr. Pink running after their heist. He's got a bag because he says he got some diamonds. That was the whole thing. They got diamonds. They were robbing the place for diamonds. But the funny thing is, so he's running. The cops are running after him. And since they didn't have budget to hire like a traffic detail, like they had to wait for like the lights to turn green. So like at various points. It's pretty cool. They show him shooting some cops and everything like that. And when they go back to the two of them in the warehouse, he's like, you kill anybody? And Harvey Guy tells us a few cops. And he's like, no real people? I mean, the cops are like, I don't know. They're treated a little, I don't know. That's probably how crooks do look at cops. But I don't know.
The gangster movie, man.
Yeah.
Bad guys are the good guys. It's flipped all around. Flippity flip.
Yeah, that's basically it. Yeah. I don't know if you're, and this is kind of like a small little detail, but if you look in the background, they're in like a sort of bathroom type area here or whatever. There's like sinks and everything. And there's bottles of detergent, and one of them is white, one of them is pink, and one of them is orange.
Oh, that's cute.
And the orange one is kind of off to the side. You wouldn't really notice that if you've never seen the movie before. So they, then they debate more with Mr. Blonde. They're debating like, well, I don't like to kill people, but I, you know, I will if I have to. But he just blew everybody away. And so this is all just like, this is the dialogue that Quentin Tarantino eventually became known for. But at the time, you're like, what is this? These guys just sitting there talking. But I do like it. You know, we have like this moment of like, who's the rat? And like, he's like, well, you know, and like, Steepy Sammy says, for all I know, you're the rat. He says, for all I know, you're the rat. He's like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, now you're thinking.
Yeah.
Now you're being smart.
Yeah. So we have our first sort of cut to, like, they do this throughout the movie, and they say, Mr. White. And this is basically Joe meeting with Harvey Keitel, Mr. White, and telling him about the job. He mentions a woman that he was pulling jobs with named Alabama, which, of course, is the name of, in True Romance, what's her name?
Alabama Worley.
Yeah, that was her name. The main.
The blonde one?
Yeah,
Patricia Arquette.
Patricia Arquette, thank you. That, couldn't think of it. But it's pretty basic. And it kind of establishes that Joe and Mr. White know each other pretty well. And they go back a ways. And so there you go. Because it all laying the groundwork. So then we cut back. White and Pink are still debating. What are they going to do? Mr. Orange says he wants, you know, he's passed out now. But, you know, he's like, oh, he said we should take him to a hospital. But then Mr. White says, well, I told him my name and where I was from. Mr. Pink is like, what the hell did you do that for?
What did you do that for?
He's like, okay, we're not taking him to the hospital because now he can, if he identifies you, they get to you, they can get to me. I don't care. And I this is kind of funny when he's like, well, if we don't take a hospital, he could die. He says, well, some fellas are lucky and some ain't. Mm-hmm. We're getting the idea that Mr. White here really, really is nice. Like he's not just a nice guy, but he's into, you know, he thinks Mr. Blonde's cool. Mr. Orange is cool and he wants to save his life. And he does feel responsible that he got shot. We finally, after they're kind of fighting it out. We have the classic, not classic at the time, sort of Tarantino standoff with two guys pointing guns at each other. Then Mr. Blonde comes in And this is 30 minutes into the movie. So this is like, this is what happens in screenwriting. Even though this movie is told
non-linear storytelling.
Non-linear storytelling, yes. It's still like basic three-act structure. 30 minutes, 30 pages about into the script. Mr. Blonde shows up and the action takes like another turn. He shows up and, they're all talking some more. And he says, I got something for you guys. But because we got to wait for Joe. I talked to nice guy Eddie. We don't know who any of these people are really, but, we get the idea. And he says, I talked to nice guy. And he says to wait. But I got something for you guys. And he goes out to actually Michael Madsen's car, his own car, because they didn't have enough budget again to rent a car. And he's got a cop in the trunk. Suddenly they're all like, oh, that's nice. Like, we have something to do. But he's like, well, maybe this, he can explain something about this rat business you've been talking about. So now we cut back to like sort of the origin of Mr. Blonde, right? And his name is Vic Vega, which of course, Quentin Tarantino lore, John Travolta's character in Pulp Fiction, his name's Vincent Vega.
Confirmed brothers.
Yeah. We find out that apparently Quentin always wanted to do like a brother movie, but they kind of got too old. So it'll never happen, but that's fine. Basically, the fewer movies that John Travolta does, the better. Oh, I'm kidding. We learn that Vic Vega, Mr. Blonde, just got out of prison. And like they're gonna help him out. Nice guy shows up. Chris Penn, nice guy is nice guy Eddie. And like we can tell they're buddies. They're like wrestling around the ground and everything and whatever. And then he says, hey, like Joe Lon Chaney is his dad. And he says, maybe we could let Vic help us, maybe he could be in on this job. That's it. He's like, how'd you feel about pulling a job with five other guys? So that's how he got in on it. Then we got to one of my favorite of Steve Wright's like voice. Somebody says like the monster truck rally down at the fairgrounds featuring the Behemoth. it's just so funny. But we get "I Gotcha" by Joe Tex while they torture this cop, and it's they intercut Chris Penn talking on the phone, his huge cell phone, by the way.
We're having a chuckle about that.
Yeah. But that's the way phones were. But that was probably like, only really rich guys have those. This is one of those scenes, like the guy in the video store, one of those scenes that people talk about. They beat up this cop and nobody liked it. So like when they were doing dailies, they wouldn't show like this scene to people, to like the money guys. Nice guy, Chris Penn, finally shows up and he's like, what are you doing? This is the cop. What are you beating on him for? They're like, well, maybe he can tell us who set us up. He's like, you fucking beat this prick long enough, it'll tell you started the goddamn Chicago fire. I don't like Chris Penn in a lot of movies. I mean, he's fine, but he's really good in this. He's great. And the other thing that I started to notice, at least, like, so this warehouse that they're filming in is actually a mortuary. And Mr. Blonde is actually sitting on a hearse. It looks like a big crate. It's like a big hearse. And there's like coffins kind of just standing up around in the background. So they're like, this Mr. Blonde shot up the place, ruined, whatever. The heist went south. They don't know that nice guy and Mr. Blonde are like old buddies. So he's like, okay, let's go pick up those diamonds that you stashed. We're going to get rid of these cars out here, and we're going to have Mr. Blonde babysit the cop and Mr. Orange. And like Harvey Keitel, Mr. White is very insane. He's like, you got to call a cop. He's like, all right, I'll call a cop. He's like, who are you going to call? He's like, not call a cop, call a doctor. He says, who are you going to call? He says, a fucking snake charmer. Now, here we are. This is the most famous scene probably in the whole movie. Mr. Blonde has the cop. They have the cop tied up to a chair. Mr. Orange is laying on the ground, bloody, which is apparently like all that fake blood because he laid there for so long, it would dry up and they'd have to like peel him off the, like, he takes out a razor. He puts on a radio to K Billy's Super Sounds of the 70s. He gets stuck in the middle with you. He tapes the guy's mouth shut, this poor cop. Who says, I don't know anything. But so he sits down, like the camera pans away, which people say this is the most violent thing ever. You don't even see him cutting the ear off, but he does, because he gets up, and I look, because it's the funniest. I mean, even if you don't, you have to like kind of crack up when he puts the ear up to his mouth and goes, "Hey, what's going on?"
It's hilarious.
It is. It is hilarious. I mean, even if you abhor violence, come on, it's pretty funny. So apparently there was a more violent version of that, and Michael Madsen was like, I don't know, this was pretty tame. People think it's so violent, but
he had a lot of problems with filming this scene in particular because he had a really young baby, and he thought that it was just violent, too much violence himself. And the cop improvised the line where he said that he had a kid. And then Michael Madsen had to like stop the filming. I needed to take a break. So
yeah,
he was having a lot of problems.
I read that. Yeah, I mean, apparently he's a super nice guy. Like Michael Madsen is, he almost always plays like kind of a shitheel, but apparently he's a really nice guy in real life. He throws the ear down, walks back out to his car. This is one shot. Like the song plays the whole time. It like fades out, and we walk back, the Steelers wheels is still playing, so it's pretty cool. He gets a gas can, he's dumping it all over the cop, and the cop is like, oh no, don't do it, because the tape like gets wet and peels off. He lights his lighter and he says, "How about a little fire, Scarecrow?" Which I thought was a good line, you know, from Wizard of Oz. And then he is shot to death by Mr. Orange. Kind of a cool shot too. Like he empties the gun, and the camera pans around, and we see like Mr. Blonde falling dead.
Dead.
Orange says, "Hey, what's your name?" And he says, "Oh, my name's Marvin Nash." And he says, "Marvin, I'm a cop." And Marvin says, "I know." I mean, that whole time he knew, like he could have, like, they're like, "Who's the rat?" He's laying right there.
Yeah, he's protecting the citizens.
Marvin's a good cop.
Yeah.
He never said anything. They cut his ear off.
It's kind of like the code of the gangster too, La Cosa Nostra, you know? Like La Cosa Nostra. It's like you don't rat on someone. You just don't do it.
I know. I mean, they probably wouldn't have let him go anyway, I suppose. I think Nice Guy Eddie even said that. It's like, well,
Marvin Berry?
That's what I said when he said his name while we were watching. He's like, "My name's Marvin.
Your cousin, Marvin Berry." Orange says, "Marvin, I need you to hold on. There's cops about a block away." And Marvin's like, "What the fuck are they waiting for?" "They want Joe Cabot." So he's like, "We're just going to sit here and bleed until he comes." So now we cut to the story of Mr. Orange. It's almost like Holy Grail. It's like the tale of Mr. Orange. But this is the part where he's got the hair, you know, the boy band hair and everything. Now, this is a scene. It's like literally like for years, it was like the Mandela effect or something. I thought that he goes in and talks to Samuel Jackson. It is not Samuel Jackson. But they meet at a diner. He meets this other undercover cop whose name in the script is just called Hold the Way. I don't know what that means, but this guy is great. This guy is a great actor. Randy Brooks. We learn about Mr. Orange, how he sort of, you know, he's an undercover cop and how he learned like how to like fit in or whatever. And one of the things is the commode story. I love the commode story.
It's done really well.
Yeah.
I love this whole thing. I like that it's kind of a mirror to Hollywood thing too, where Tim Roth's like, there's like four pages of this stuff. I'm supposed to remember this stuff, you know? It's like he ends up a script and he's like, "No, you need to remember all the details. Make it your own. Like you're telling a joke." Like, yeah. I thought that was fucking awesome.
I know it is. It's great. And yeah, and I love when he's just like, "If you ain't a great actor, you're a bad actor." I mean, it's just true, right? I mean, you have to, if you're not great, and what's the difference? And if it's an undercover cop, you're going to get killed if you're not great, you know? So he's like, "Yeah, you got to be naturalistic." And I love what obviously, like the best line to me, the whole thing is what he's telling him about. This story takes place in a men's room, so you got to know all the details about the men's room. And he says, "If some dirty, scum-ridden motherfucker sprayed diarrhea all over one of the bowls." Like, what? Just like the way he says it. It's classic. But yeah, and the progression of like first he's rehearsing in his apartment. And he's got a Silver Surfer poster back there, which is great. And then they show him like practicing it like in front of Holdaway. And I love another great line where he's talking about his friend. It's about like selling weed. So these guys, they call me up. And motherfucker, I'm trying to watch The Lost Boys. That's great. And then they show him
getting weed back then was a whole thing. It was difficult to do. And you did usually get fucking shitty weed and all the stuff he was saying about like, oh, you wanted to get the California tie stick. I was like, yeah, man. That was hard to come by back then.
Well, I guess the point of the story was that there was a drought. He says, like, the marijuana drought of 1986.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he's... They
but The Lost Boys came in 1987.
Oh, no, you're right.
Well, the poke a hole in his whole story. Good thing no one knew that.
I know. Then they show him telling Joe and Nice Guy Eddie and Harvey Keitel. And you can tell Harvey Keitel's like, oh, yeah. Because the whole point of the story is he walks into the men's room with this, like, bag, this, like, carry-on bag of weed, and there's four cops in there and a dog, like a police dog, and they're all just looking at him. And, like, he's, like, telling the story in the story, kind of, and the camera's going around him. It's very cool. He's like, panic hits me like a bucket of water. Bam! And the way he goes and uses the hand blower is just perfect. It's, this is really good. I mean, this is Mr. Orange. My another great line is when he's talking about, he's telling the story, and Joe says, oh, the only way you can handle that is shit your pants, then jump in and swim.
I always liked the way he compared Joe to the Thing. He's like, you remember the Fantastic Four?
Yeah.
The invisible bitch.
Flame on.
Flame on and shit.
My date at many, many occasions.
The invisible bitch? Oh, that's right.
To take pictures next to her at our parties, yeah.
There was another part that I think is a great character moment. It happened a couple minutes before this, but like when he's talking about he got a referral, he's like, oh yeah, Long Beach Mike, gave me a referral. And he's like, yeah, he's a good guy. You should, do right by him and hold away. It's just like, no, man, this guy's a fucking scumbag. Which is kind of like, it seems, makes you think like Mr. Orange isn't, maybe he's not cut out for this or something. It's like, oh, yeah.
Too trusting.
Yeah.
So is Harvey Keitel, though.
Yeah. Yes, it's true. So the next scene, they pick up Mr. Orange's apartment. Again, you see he's got a Thing action figure even down there. And you see his Silver Surfer poster, and it's a cool moment where he looks at himself in the mirror and he says, you're fucking Beretta. They don't know. You're super cool. And I like Mr. Orange wears a wedding ring, whereas Noonday, the cop, is not. Kind of cool. So he goes out of the car, and yeah, we hear the, as Clay pointed out to me earlier, we get hooked on a feeling, which was also in Guardians of the Galaxy. And I said, I bet... Oh, sorry, please.
No, go ahead. I have something to add after this.
I was just going to say, I would bet like serious life-changing money that James Gunn is a huge fan.
I could see that. I wanted to go back to the scene where Steve Buscemi is being chased. Wait, has that happened yet?
Yeah.
Okay. So where he's being chased and he knocks a guy over, and low in the mix you could hear the Wilhelm scream.
Oh, really? Nice. I do love that part. It's almost like a video game or something. You could hear a guy say, what's your fucking problem, man? Or something like that. And I also like, this is sort of unnecessary, but again, it kind of shows you like a cop perspective as Mr. Orange is getting in the car. It's from the perspective of like, you don't see, it's off camera, but it's like two cops following him. And he's like, oh, you got to have rocks in the head the size of Gibraltar to work undercover. And it's like, give me the bear claw. Yeah. It's kind of like the cop donuts thing was always kind of like it was a big thing in the 90s. But yeah, hooked on a feeling. So we get more 70s music. He tells this funny story, kind of racist. There's a lot of N-words used in this movie.
He used the N-word a lot.
He loves using that word.
Yeah. Talking about this girl who glued her husband's dick to his belly or whatever, and they're all laughing. It's kind of just like Mr. Orange is, he's fitting in and he's in the clique, I think he's kind of even enjoying it. But then we cut to the scene where they're talking about the robbery. And this is kind of the famous scene, as you referenced earlier. He says, you're all going to be using aliases. And he gets to Mr. Pink. CB7's like, why am I Mr. Pink? He says, because you're a faggot, all right? And the famous line, yeah. Well, just, I don't know, my brother and I quote this all the time when he says, you're not Mr. Purple. Some guy on some other job is Mr. Purple. You're Mr. Pink. And I couldn't, I guess, wanted to get a couple lines in or something, but he says, Mr. Brown's a little too close to Mr. Shit. So it's just fun, and it establishes, you know, whatever. These guys talk like normal guys, even though they're criminals. And now, you know, this shit happens all the time. But back then, you didn't really get a lot of this. So it's pretty cool. We have another sort of scene with Mr. White and Mr. Orange kind of going over what the plan is for the robbery. They're talking about, oh, you know, he's like, if you can't get the manager to give you the diamonds, cut off one of his fingers. It's like, oh. It's another famous thing from the soundtrack. And I probably put it on a mixtapes back then. Probably, yeah. Yeah. And then, but I love it. He says, let's get a taco.
Yeah, like, I'm hungry.
Yeah. After he talks about cutting off a guy's fingers and whatever, he's like, I'm hungry. Let's get a taco.
Yeah, bashing him in the face with the butt of your gun and all that
stuff. Yeah. Smash. Yeah. Take the butt of your gun and smash his nose in. So then we cut to the aftermath of the robbery. They're trying to get away. Mr. Brown, Quentin, has blood all over his face because he's been shot in the head. He crashes the car. Mr. White takes out two guns, and it's pretty much exactly like a scene from Better Tomorrow where Chow Yun-Fat shot up a cop car, and Mr. White kills two cops but just by shooting the windshield. Now Orange is kind of looking on. He looks kind of sad. I mean, obviously he's sad. He's like, oh, two cops just got killed.
A love letter on Tarantino's part to that movie.
Absolutely. I mean, he admits to not, it's not stealing. Yeah, I mean, but he admits homage. To taking stuff. Yeah.
Homage.
He admits.
Pastiche. Fully admits. Like, with, I mean, I think he's brilliant, and it sounds a little reductive to say, but all his movies steal from the greats. I mean, that's what makes him such a great filmmaker.
Much like Dirk started it.
Exactly. Great. So why they go, they steal a car. There's a woman in the car who is actually Tim Roth's voice coach, apparently. She, as they're going around, she shoots him. He shoots her. And we're back to where we started.
Driving 50 miles an hour.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, like, this guy's a cop. I guess that's a natural instinct, I guess. If you're a cop and you have a gun and someone shoots you, you shoot them. I don't know. He did look kind of sad. But he wasn't shot by one of the cops. Like, I think the whole movie, you think, oh, this guy got shot during this robbery. And Harvey Keitel's like, oh, it's my fault. But it was just
it's a carjacking that he gets shot.
Yeah. So they cut back. Everybody's back at the warehouse. Nice guy, Eddie. They find Mr. Blonde dead. And the hell happened? And then he shoots poor Marvin. And he slashed the cop's face and cut off his ear. And he was going to burn him. And he's like, this cop? And he just shoots him. It's like, oh, okay, well, that's enough of that. Poor Marvin.
Well, yeah, poor Marvin, but better go that way than burned.
Yeah, right. Getting burned wouldn't have been too Jeez. Good.
Unless he had the Mr. Orange effect and is bleeding everywhere. Yeah,
just has blood everywhere.
Jeez.
So I don't know if this is true. I read that there was like they had a paramedic on the set to kind of say, like, is this the right amount of blood? We'll see. I mean, they had a medical professional there. Anyway, so Mr. Orange tells this story that Mr. Blonde was going to kill all of them, take the diamonds and go. As soon as they got back with the diamonds, he was going to kill everybody.
I kill the bus driver.
Oh, no. I kill the bus driver. So then Ice Guy Eddie says, so this guy who you just said was going to kill us all just did 4 years for my father. He could have, you know, ratted us out and walked, but he didn't. He did his time like a man. And I love it. As he's yelling at him, he's like, he's just going to decide. Out of the fucking blue, and he's spinning all over the place. It's kind of cool. So he's like, why don't you tell us what really happened? And then Joe walks in. He's like, yeah, just be more bullshit. So he knows that Mr. Orange is the cop. And Mr. White is like, Joe, no, you're wrong. I know this kid. He wouldn't do that. And Joe's like, ah. He also, there's like a funny line here too. So like there was a Mr. Blue who we haven't mentioned because he almost does nothing in the movie at all.
He's just like sitting there.
Yeah. Mr. Blue has two lines, but he says, Mr. Blue is dead or whatever. And he's like, and Pink's like, Blue is dead? Dead as Dillinger. Lawrence Tierney played Dillinger in a different, a different role, but yeah. So Joe pulls out his gun in Orange and he says, you know, I wasn't 100% on him, but now, you know, I'm going to make up for it, whatever. And White's like, no, Joe, I can't let you do that. And he pulls his gun. And then Nice Guy Eddie pulls his gun. Says, you know, put your gun down. We've done a lot of jobs. We can work through this. And I love Mr. Pink's like, hey, guys, let's be professional. And then it's kind of like, you know, it's tough. There was a lot of debate back then and a lot of people playing it in slow motion, I think, on their VHSs. But everybody shoots everybody, basically.
The Mexican standoff that Tarantino was fully well known for as well.
Right. This is where it's
not the inventor of, but
no, but he loves it.
An innovator. Yep. He loves it.
So Mr. Like White,
if I made a movie, there'd be a train play.
That's right. It'd be what you were known for. So Mr. White got off two shots before he got shot by Nice Guy Eddie. And he's lying on the ground and he's like, again, acting like he's in a lot of pain. Now, Mr. Pink had dove under this, like the ramp. Like there's like a ramp.
He lived, right? He got out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a lot of background talk that like he grabs the satchel of diamonds, he runs out, but then you hear sirens and a lot of yelling, and it's kind of assumed that he got caught. But he lived, unless they shot him. Okay. Oh. But yeah.
I have a feeling he would have surrendered.
Yeah.
Yeah, he probably would have surrendered. Yeah.
I don't think he got away. He definitely, going after him. Yeah.
Here's what he did. He disguised himself as a high school student, got a skateboard, went to the local high school, and then was like, hello, fellow kid students, or whatever the line is.
How are you doing, fellow kids?
Yeah.
There wasn't some people, there's like a fan theory that like he went, like he laid low and he became the, because C.P. Semi plays the waiter in Pulp Fiction in the restaurant that John Travolta and Uma Thurman go to. So they're like, oh, he like
Jack Rabbit Slim.
Yeah. He was Buddy Holly, the waiter. I don't know. Yeah, your theory is a lot better. Yeah. He pretended to be a high school student. Hello.
Well, did we talk about the white and orange guns going off and what happened there? Like, did Mr. White get shot by the cop?
We're getting there. I was just about to talk about that. Yeah, we're getting there. I don't mean we'll get there, like we'll get there in 15 minutes. We're there. So yeah, there is like, you know, Mr. White crawls over, he's in pain, and he actually says, it looks like we're going to do a little time. And then Orange tells him.
So why does he tell? Why does he say I'm a cop?
I think he feels bad. He says, I'm sorry, Larry.
I would have just been like, sorry. I would have kept saying sorry, sure, but I wouldn't have been like, I'm sorry because I'm a cop.
And this guy just like defended him, you know, like to his old buddy.
I think there's kind of a mutual respect and a bromance between these two. And, you know, they both know they're done.
I wouldn't have said I was a cop, but I would have tried to pull some strings afterwards to make sure he got a lighter sentence or something because he was good to me.
They both know they're done for.
He combed my hair and he held me. So, I mean, you know, he deserves that much.
How could he be thinking straight either? Like, he's lost like fucking like 3 gallons of blood. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Having
he looks pale like Bela Lugosi.
Having lost a lot of blood before, it still didn't make me want to admit something that I wouldn't want to admit to. It made me almost want to die and pass out on the floor, but I still wasn't going to admit that I was a cop.
He has now been shot twice because Joe did shoot him before Mr. White shot Joe and then shot Nice Guy Eddie. But I'm going to go with my – I think Clay is right. He knows he's done for, and he just wanted to clear his conscience and say –
his last words.
Yeah, he says, Larry, he says, I'm sorry.
But then, as your last words, you're going to make Harvey Keitel feel like an idiot. So I would have just been like, I'm sorry.
Because, yeah, Harvey Keitel and his, like, moaning kind of just goes like it gets worse as after he tells him he's a cop.
Chewbacca.
He puts his gun to his head. He's, like, kind of cradling his head. And, yeah, like, this is another thing that fans have debated, I think, for a long time. Cops come in, you hear them yet, say, put the gun down, put the gun down. And then you hear one gun go off, and then you hear a lot of other guns go off, and Harvey Keitel sort of falls off screen. And I think I mean, I'm pretty sure Harvey Keitel shot Mr. Orange, and then he was killed by the cops.
That's what I think, too. But yeah, we
but
don't
here,
have a definitive
But here case. Is my other theory.
Go
before
ahead.
Before they did all this, he took the super soldier serum. And
so he became the fucking
I'm just going to tie in everybody else's. Yeah, I'm going to tie in everybody else's roles into this one. So do you know one of the things about Harvey Keitel is he looks like he's like 5'4". And maybe it's just because he's so wide. But
I don't think the suit
really
does
short.
Him any favors at this
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, I don't think he it's... is short, but he just looks like a really small person. He looks like a human frog, kind of.
5'7".
Like 5'7". Okay. Yeah, that's not really tall. But,
it's not
I mean,
tall.
It's,
no.
It's taller than I thought he was.
He does look... I think some of the way this movie's shot, sometimes it looks like a lot of long shots and stuff, and I think he does... make him look shorter. I think he's shorter than most of his scenes are with Steve Buscemi. And I think Steve Buscemi's probably a little bit, well, not a lot, but a little bit taller than him. And it does kind of just make him look shorter.
The style of clothes in the 90s at that point was a lot looser and baggier. So that probably is also contributing to it.
Yeah. I can't believe he wore that stuff. But we get the Lime and the Coconut song and the credits. And that's the end of Reservoir Dogs.
Steve Buscemi is 5'9".
Ah,
he's the same height as me.
Just a little bit taller than Harvey Keitel. So there you go. That was, the movie. It had a lot of copycats. Quentin Tarantino, you know, he even made a joke, which he's not going to do, but he made a joke on Bill Maher that, like, because he supposedly is going to do one more movie and then retire. And he says he would remake Reservoir Dogs. Like, I'm going to make my first movie as my last movie. But he's like, no, I'm not really going to do it. He's like, but I've definitely laid awake at night thinking, I wonder.
I know. It's something.
But everyone else has basically ripped this one off. Like I said, a lot of movies now have the criminals talk like they're, you know, on Seinfeld or whatever. Maybe not now, but for years.
Was it like 2 days in the Valley or something?
Yeah. Yeah. That was one. It was a lot like a Tarantino movie. Yeah. Like moving around, different stories, different people. I mean, I kind of like
Bad Lieutenant
with Harvey Keitel.
A lot of these guys played the same character many times over at Apple too. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Sometimes I like movies that, I mean, you could say they're kind of copycats or kind of movies or whatever, but like a Magnolia or something like that. I like that movie. You know, with like different stories that going on and some of them kind of come together at the end. It's kind of a Tarantino thing, but when done well.
Damn, Bad Lieutenant was 1992 too. Wow.
Yeah, I don't know if that wasn't necessarily a...
Bad Lieutenant is good movie.
Good.
You were saying you like the copycat movies though. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I mean, that's sometimes they're good. They're done well, but a lot of people did it. That's all. Like in this, you know, like I said,
I mean, do you have the Sopranos without, you know, Reservoir Dogs? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it kind of...
I don't know. It's a good point.
That was like gangsters. I mean, not was a heist film, but, you know, gangsters and how they would really be kind of thing.
Right. Right. I mean, like, sure. A few years before this, we had like Goodfellas where like they were talking about, you know, looking at the painting or whatever. Like the criminals are like, you know, we're all right, guys. You know, this was just a different kind of movie. I mean, it was the style at the time, but this was the one that started that style. And yeah, I think, you know, despite Tim Roth's hair, it's
still got good hair. It's just kind of it's 90s boy band hair.
Yeah. I mean, I'm jealous. I wish I had hair like that. Even as an I guess I did in 92,
yeah,
or maybe
you still had hair. You're still a good hair.
I did. I don't know if I had that much. Maybe 94, I kind of started to really grow it out. It's funny how like some movies, especially this era, I guess it's some of them are product of their time, and some of them are just plain out dated. You know what I mean? Like these, some of them are just plain dated, and some of them are like, well, that was the style at the time. It's funny. It's like a fine line sometimes.
Fine line between clever and stupid.
It's right. It really is, actually. So, I don't know. What do we think about Reservoir Dogs?
Well, you get to pick the order.
Oh, because it's... Is that how we're doing? I forgot. Okay.
That's how I did it last time.
Oh, did you go last?
Because I said I get to pick the order.
I know,
but director's series.
Did you pick yourself to go last?
Why don't you go ahead and listen to our...
Yeah, go back and listen to our...
I went last.
All right. I think I'll go first. Why not? I'm gonna go first.
Episode.
I know, I talk a lot. Sorry. Well, I won't take too much time. I mean, I already said...
You like it. You
love
it.
This is an A. This is an A movie. Yes, there are... I joke about the crew member in the background or whatever. Like, there are a few little mistakes, and you can see Tarantino was getting there, but this I think it's one of his best movies. I don't know which one is his best one. I mean, people love Pulp Fiction. That was the one that came after this one, and he won this Oscar for screenplay. It was nominated for Best Picture, all that stuff. Like, this was the one. I think this is it. This is the one. You could tell he was just, I'm gonna throw everything at this movie.
He was hungry.
Yeah, exactly. Young and hungry. All of his film knowledge went into this. And he, you know, he was just going for it. And it was perfect. It was great. I love it. It's an A. Performances are awesome. Even Lawrence Tierney, who apparently was hard and he didn't remember his lines a lot, but that's all right. It's still great. Everybody's great. That's it. That's all I got. A. Flat A.
There you go.
Who's going next? Oh, go. John was about to say it, so you can go.
Yeah, I'll go next. I don't have much to say because you pretty much said it all. I'm going to give it an A-. It is my favorite of the Tarantino films I've seen, which I haven't seen the last few. The dialogue's good, even though I find Tarantino annoying as an actor and as a person. And cast is great. They do a lot with a little. And that's it. A-. That's what I got.
That's good. Very, very good. Very well.
All right. Think? I guess it's my turn now.
Now.
I'm going to do something that might surprise you. I'm going to give this movie an A+.
Oh,
I gave Reservoir Dogs an
A+. Entire spectrum.
Spectrum of A's. And here's why. I don't mind, and I kind of embrace the little imperfections, like, you know, Kylo Ren when he puts his helmet back together with the little goop inside of it, you know, and it's like, whoa, it was broken, but then he fixed it.
Making a Kylo Ren reference just dropped my score down.
The Kylo Ren's not in the movie.
Doesn't matter now. It's associated with the movie.
I don't even think he was born when this. I mean, he might have been very young when this movie came out. Yeah. Anyway, continue.
I love the passion. When I was in college, this was like the biggest thing. And much like you with wanting to, I've always had dreams, like wanted to be an astronaut, wanted to make movies, wanted to write books or whatever. I never did anything. I'm on a podcast 30 years later talking about how great
you're
this movie
like,
is.
You're on like six podcasts. So,
yeah.
It's like your pod reveal.
I'm proud of where I am. But
you got your little van that you drive around.
My podcast rover. My rover. But, anyways, I give it an A+ because all imperfections don't bother me as a negative. In fact, I think it's a plus. The guy wrote the thing in 3 weeks, scraped together the money. You know, like, I'm going to give you another reference that you're going to hate, which is the Clerks thing. You know, like, when
I like Clerks.
I know you like Clerks, but I'm saying, like, Tarantino and Kevin Smith, you know, you talk about the people and people get upset, and I'm not trying to upset anyone, but like the grit, the sheer power of getting this movie out and having the dialogue be flawless and imitated a million times.
Can I say something? I think the difference between Kevin Smith and Quentin Tarantino was that there's much more polish on Tarantino's first film, and he's using established actors.
Yeah, using actors who can read dialogue.
Kevin Smith was like just getting anybody he knew to be in it. But right. I see your point.
I know what you're saying, the grittiness and the like, I'm going to get this done no matter what.
I'm going to get this done. And that was like inspirational to me then in 1992, as well as it's inspirational to me now. Like I and then you see like all the great movies he's made since then. I mean, it's hard to pick a favorite for me, but like one of my favorites is Jackie Brown. And that's like a random one. That wouldn't even come up in conversation. You know, like
you're right.
I just really love this movie. I love the gangster shit. I love him beating up on cops. I love how he makes, even in the commode story, how he makes a fool of those cops in there. Like I fucking love, I loved that then and I love it now. I'm not saying we should tie up all cops to chairs and pour gas on them. No, I'm not saying that. But I love the anti-authoritarianism of that. And even his like use of, you know, words we wouldn't say now, and like just how he writes and how he made this vision on screen and how it was his first movie, and he's gonna make 10 movies in his life or whatever. It's fucking awesome. It's A+ for me. A+.
I like it. I agree. Back then, like this era, obviously I don't think it came out in 92. I'm sure I didn't see it till 93 or maybe even 94 by the time I got around to it. But like I was a pretty big fan of Quentin Tarantino. I even liked, as I said, I liked Natural Born Killers and True Romance, which he didn't even direct, but he wrote. And I was like,
and From Dusk Till Dawn.
Well,
they're not all winners.
He didn't direct that one. He was in it, but like
he wrote it too, right?
I think he co-wrote it with Robert Rodriguez, but Robert Rodriguez
was like a co-producer or something.
Yeah, Robert Rodriguez is another guy. Like, same thing. Came up that same way. He made a movie, like, by selling his blood, like, to make El Mariachi. Like,
no wonder he did a movie about vampires.
Yeah, right. Seriously. And he was like, I'm going to play my own music in this movie. I'm going to be the caterer. He still is. Like, when he makes a movie, he is literally the caterer of his. Now he's, like, a big name. And he's like, yeah, I just do it for fun now. But back then, he did it just to save money. This was the golden era of this kind of filmmaking, and this was kind of the one that people got the idea, oh, we can do this. This is one of the, you know, there were guys before Quentin, but yeah, I mean, it's great. Like, maybe Kevin Smith would have made a movie on his own if he hadn't seen, I mean, maybe he would have. We made Durst and the Firestarter. Let's go back and listen to our Durst and the Firestarter episode. Yeah. But like, you know, this was a big one. Got people thinking, I can make my own movie the way I want, and I'm going to try it. So that's why I picked this one, because even though like Pulp Fiction is more notable, and I think like Inglourious Basterds might be my favorite Tarantino movie, so, and that's way later. But we're talking about director series, and which one are we going to pick? And this was my pick for that reason. So,
Thing I wanted to say was just like, whether it be like Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns or this movie or Clerks, like when I went to art school and you went to film school, it's like, even though I didn't think I was going to make a Reservoir Dogs movie, I totally was, like, no joke, like inspired by, like, I want to do cool shit in my life. I want to do cool stuff like this. I don't know how this guy did it, but damn. and we watched the originals. El Mariachi, or like we would get like the DVDs of that and like watch like the, what do we call it, like the pilot movie, his first Rodriguez's first movie, you know, before it's like all he remade it and made it kind of polished, you know,
right?
But like all of that stuff was, I was just taking it all in and listening to Nine Inch Nails and like just getting crazy with it. Yeah, and this is definitely part of that source material that makes up a rich life.
Oh, yeah. The cultural zeitgeist or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, this movie was like a big deal back in the day. And it was one of those big deals, like it became a big deal because people rented it. So it's pretty cool. It's a good, the story about the movie is as good as the story in the movie. So the commode story, I mean, that's a good story. Yeah. So I think that's all we got, right? Do you have anything else? Anybody have anything else? But listen, thanks for listening.
Thanks and to you.
Check us out, leaguepodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And check us out on YouTube. Clay posts a lot of fun stuff over there. Follow, like, subscribe, all those things that people do these days. And then go out and rent Reservoir Dogs at your local video store.
Other two director series, North by Northwest and Dr. Strangelove, are on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.
Ah, I like it. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you later.
Adios.
I fall off my chair and I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you. And I'm wondering what it is.
I'm hungry. Let's get a taco.